So imagine a massive organizational crisis. Just, take a second and picture one in your mind right now.
Yeah, usually people go straight to the worst-case scenario.
Right, like a catastrophic data breach that just bankrupts a tech firm overnight.
Or a really horrific act of workplace violence.
Exactly. Or maybe like a deeply entrenched financial scandal that suddenly hits the front page of the Wall Street Journal and it just, wipes out half a company's market cap in a day.
Oh, absolutely. When we conceptualize these failures, our brains just naturally default to the loud stuff.
Yeah, we picture the climax, right? We think of sirens blaring, breaking news chyrons flashing across the bottom of a screen.
Federal agents walking out with boxes of hard drives.
Yes, and executives just sweating under the glare of camera lights.
It's pure chaos. I mean, our entire cultural understanding of a crisis is almost completely defined by high visibility, high decibel
We
reaction.
focus on the explosion.
Right.
But, and this is the big question, what if the most critical defining phase of that entire crisis wasn't the explosion at all?
What if it was something else entirely?
Exactly. What if the absolute most important window of time was actually completely silent?
That is exactly the premise we are exploring today.
It is. We are going on a really extensive deep dive into this brilliant book. It's called The Space Before Crisis by Daniel Schneider.
Such a fascinating read.
It really is. And our mission for this conversation is to completely dismantle and rebuild how you understand organizational safety, risk, and internal communication.
Because it really applies to everyone.
Totally. Whether you are managing a corporate team of 500, volunteering at a local community center, or even running a high school classroom.
Or if you're just, insanely curious about why massive, well-funded institutions constantly miss giant, glaring red flags.
Right. This material is going to change how you look at the world.
Yeah.
Because the core thesis here is just wild.
It really flips everything on its head.
Yeah, organizations do not fail because they ignore a blaring alarm. They fail because they fundamentally misunderstand, mismanage, and completely ignore the quiet space before the alarm.
Because we have this deeply ingrained, almost cinematic assumption that risk announces itself to us.
Right, like a movie villain.
Exactly. We assume that before something terrible happens, a villain is going to monologue or someone is going to break a very clear, documented rule.
Or cross some massive, obvious threshold that triggers an automated alert.
Yeah, but Schneider's work points out that the real world just doesn't operate like that at all.
Not even a little bit.
The earliest phase of harm doesn't look like an emergency. It just looks like ambiguity.
Ambiguity, yeah.
It is defined by incomplete information, by people hesitating, and by a really deadly organizational habit of waiting for undeniable hard proof before anyone decides to actually do anything.
So I want to spend some time really visualizing the anatomy of this quiet space. Like, what are we actually talking about when we say ambiguity?
Right, because we need to define it.
Because Schneider makes it really clear that we aren't talking about a dramatic policy violation.
No, not at all.
If someone punches a hole in the drywall, that's not the quiet space, that's a policy violation.
You don't need a deep dive to know that punching a wall is bad.
Exactly. The quiet space is way more subtle. So let's invent a hypothetical to track this.
Okay, let's do it.
Imagine an employee. Let's call him David.
Okay,
The
Bowen.
quiet space is David, who used to be, super engaged in morning meetings, suddenly becoming really
She's
withdrawn.
missing deadlines.
Right, missing deadlines, giving unusually cynical or aggressive responses to basic questions.
Just a subtle shift over like 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Huh?
Or maybe it's a volunteer at your church whose behavior just feels a little, I don't know, a little off.
It's that informal complaint whispered between two colleagues in a break room about a weird vibe.
Yes, a weird vibe that never actually gets formalized into an official HR document.
And if you look at those individual data points in complete isolation, none of them actually look like a crisis.
They don't. They just look like everyday life.
Right, they just look like normal operational friction. I
Yeah.
mean, David might just be going through a bad breakup.
Or the volunteer might just be tired.
Exactly. No rule is technically being broken. No HR policy is explicitly triggered.
The company's compliance dashboard is completely green. Everything is fine.
Right. So what happens in a typical organization?
I mean, the moment just passes.
Yeah. Leadership looks at their measurable, quantitative indicators, sees that everything is technically functioning within normal parameters, and they do absolutely nothing.
Which honestly leads us to a really uncomfortable realization about human behavior in the workplace.
Oh, it gets very uncomfortable.
When people see something weird, like when a colleague gets that visceral gut feeling that something is seriously off with David, they do not stay quiet by accident.
No, they do not.
Silence is a learned behavior.
It absolutely is.
People stay quiet because the organization actively, even if it's completely unintentional, teaches them to stay quiet.
You really have to look at the mechanics of what modern organizations actually reward and punish.
Okay, let's unpack this. What do they reward?
Well, most professional environments place a massive premium on decisiveness, efficiency, and data.
They want the metrics.
They want the metrics. So from day one, employees learn that bringing up a vague gut feeling without a spreadsheet to back it up is a huge personal and professional risk.
Wow. Yeah. That makes so much sense.
If you escalate an issue to your manager and you don't have hard proof, you risk looking alarmist.
You risk looking difficult to work with.
Or worse, you look like you're trying to start a witch hunt against a coworker.
It's pure self-protection. I mean, if I know my boss is going to demand a paper trail and all I have is, hey, David has been acting really strange and making some unsettling comments under his breath, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
It's the safest bet for you, personally?
It totally is. It actually reminds me of noticing a strange rattling sound in your car engine.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. You're driving down the highway. You hear this subtle, like, clink, clink, clink. You know your car. You know that sound is not supposed to be there.
But you don't know exactly what it is.
Exactly. And diagnosing a weird feeling or an unfamiliar sound is so much harder than diagnosing a lit-up dashboard.
It really is.
If the check engine light is on, you have permission to go to the mechanic. The car is explicitly telling you it's broken.
But if it's just a sound?
You hesitate. Because what if you take it to the shop, the mechanic drives it, hears absolutely nothing, and charges you $200 just to laugh you out of the garage?
Right. Nobody wants to be that person.
So what do? You wait. You wait for the dashboard to light up because then you have undeniable proof.
You have the beta.
Exactly. But I have to wonder, I mean, is waiting really that negligent, or is that just an unavoidable feature of human nature?
Well, what's fascinating here is that it's a completely natural human reflex, which is exactly why the car analogy works so well.
Right.
Waiting actually feels responsible. It feels measured. Yeah. You are essentially telling yourself, I'm not going to overreact. I'll just, you know, monitor the situation.
Yeah, you feel like you're being a steady leader.
But this is where organizational leaders make a catastrophic error. They interpret that calm, that quiet period of waiting as stability.
Oh, wow.
They mistake the absence of formal reports for the absence of actual risk.
So if nobody is submitting a formal HR grievance about David, leadership assumes David is perfectly fine.
Exactly. But the threshold for action in an organization isn't a technical threshold. It's entirely cultural.
Okay, explain that. Cultural versus technical.
It's dictated by how much ambiguity leadership is actually willing to tolerate before they start paying attention.
Right. So the check engine light is the technical threshold. It's binary. It's on or off.
Yes.
But the rattling sound is the cultural threshold. Like, will your manager roll their eyes at you for bringing in a concern that just sounds weird?
And if they roll their eyes at you once?
Oh, you are never bringing them a subtle problem ever again. You will literally wait until the engine drops out of the car on the highway.
Exactly. You are culturally conditioned to wait for the catastrophic breakdown.
That is terrifying.
And what Schneider really emphasizes here is that deferring recognition of a problem does not preserve your neutrality.
It doesn't.
No, it actively changes the trajectory of the risk.
How so?
Because by the time that issue becomes undeniable, by the time David crosses a line and the alarm is blaring, you have lost all of your low-cost options. You are now reacting under immense pressure with massive potential liabilities instead of just engaging quietly and conversationally months ago when you actually had choices.
I'm struggling a bit with how companies view this, though.
Yeah, it's a shift.
Because if I look at Fortune 500 companies, I mean, they sell the billions of dollars every single year on what they call prevention.
They sure do.
But if they're still making this fundamental error about the quiet space, then we have a terminology problem. It seems like organizations don't actually know what the word prevention means.
That is absolutely correct.
They seem to confuse it with things they can easily just, you know, write a check for.
This is perhaps the most critical conceptual distinction in the entire source material.
Really?
Yes. Because in the corporate world, we use words like safety, preparedness, security, and prevention completely interchangeably.
We throw them all into the exact same bucket.
But mechanically, they are profoundly different domains. They operate on different timelines and address entirely different types of risk.
Okay, let's break these down meticulously, because untangling these definitions was a huge aha moment for me when I was reading the book.
It's eye-opening.
Let's start with prevention versus safety. What is the actual difference? Because most people think a safe workplace is a prevented workplace.
Sure, they sound like the same thing.
But safety is really about managing physical conditions and unintentional harm, right?
Yes.
It's the wet floor sign in the hallway.
Yeah.
It's the fire extinguisher on the wall. It's mandatory CPR training for floor wardens.
Exactly. With safety, you aren't dealing with a malicious adversary.
Right. You are dealing with gravity, friction, and accidents.
Prevention, on the other hand, engages with emerging human intent.
That's a vital line to draw. Emerging human intent.
It really is. Safety assumes no malice. A wet floor doesn't want to hurt you, it's just wet. But prevention has to grapple with human psychology, complex behavior, and decision-making long before those things manifest into a physical hazard.
Okay, that makes sense. And then we have an even more dangerous confusion, right? The conflation of prevention and preparedness.
Oh, this one is huge.
Preparedness. This is the one that gives everyone such a false sense of security.
It really does.
Preparedness is your active shooter lockdown drill. It's your hurricane evacuation plan.
Yes, exactly.
Preparedness inherently assumes that the chaos has already started and asks the question, how do we manage the damage?
It completely accepts that the event is happening.
Right. But prevention operates completely upstream from that.
Yes, it asks a different question entirely.
Prevention asks, why was this human being allowed to progress down a path of grievance to the point where they felt violence was their only option in the first place?
Exactly. Preparedness is fundamentally reactive.
Okay.
Now, to be clear, it is absolutely essential. I mean, you must be prepared.
Of course, yeah. No one is saying don't run fire drills.
Right. But when organizations mislabel their preparedness initiatives as prevention initiatives, they generate this very dangerous false reassurance among their leadership.
So an executive board will sit in a meeting and think, well, we just ran a highly successful active shooter protocol drill, so we are proactively preventing violence.
And that's just factually incorrect. No, you aren't. You are preparing to react to violence after prevention has already failed.
Wow. That is a heavy distinction.
It is.
And that leads to the biggest trap of all. The one that executives fall into the hardest, mostly because, honestly, it's the easiest one to throw money at.
Physical security.
Exactly. Conflating prevention with physical security. Because security is tangible, right?
Very tangible.
It's a biometric badge scanner. It's a network of 4K surveillance cameras. It's hiring armed guards for the lobby.
Right. Security manages physical boundaries.
But mechanically, it requires a threshold to be crossed in order to activate.
Yes. Someone has to swipe an invalid badge or smash a window or pull a weapon.
Because security responds to presence or force.
Exactly. It is not designed to engage with human intent before that intent manifests into a physical action.
Okay, I have to push back here, though.
Sure, go ahead.
Let's put ourselves in the shoes of a CEO. If my company spends $2 million on a state-of-the-art surveillance system, reinforced glass, and highly trained armed guards.
Which is a lot of money.
It is.
Yeah.
Doesn't that inherently prevent bad things from happening?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't deterrence a highly effective form of prevention?
That's the logical leap most people make.
Right. If a bad actor sees the cameras, they might just turn around and walk away.
It's a very common argument, but deterrence and prevention are not synonymous.
They aren't.
No. If we connect this to the bigger picture, deterrence might make a distressed or malicious individual choose a different target.
Okay. Yeah.
Or it might delay their action until they find a vulnerability. But deterrence hasn't actually addressed the underlying trajectory of the risk.
The person still has the intent.
Exactly. Security responds to incidents. Prevention influences trajectories.
Trajectories. That's a great word for it.
If you expect a security guard or a camera system to prevent a crisis when the early warning signs, the subtle behavioral shifts, the whispers of a grievance were happening in a break room 3 months ago, you are placing your security apparatus in an impossible position.
That paints such a vivid picture of the limitation. A 4K camera cannot record a weird vibe in the break room.
It cannot.
It can't capture the fact that David is suddenly making intensely cynical comments about the company's leadership. The camera can only record the violence 3 months later.
Precisely. And when executives conflate these two things, they burden their security personnel with expectations that are structurally impossible to meet.
Because you are asking a lobby guard to identify malicious intent in a split second without any historical context about the employee.
Yes. You are asking a camera to interpret nuanced human behavior without any authority to intervene.
It's completely backward.
Security exists to manage boundaries. Prevention works upstream to ensure those boundaries are less likely to be challenged in the first place.
They are sequential.
Yes. Prevention happens first. Security is the absolute last line of defense.
Okay, so if we establish that we can't just write a check for $1 million security system and call it prevention.
Right.
And we know we can't just buy safety and call it prevention. Mm-hmm. What do organizations do next?
Usually they try a different tactic.
They buy expensive reporting software.
Mm.
Or they hire a highly credentialed specialist.
Yes. And this leads us directly into another massive vulnerability. The information trap and the myth of the lone expert.
Let's talk about the data here, because this is where the statistical data becomes incredibly compelling.
It really does. Schneider references extensive research from the FBI's National Threat Assessment Center, commonly known as NTC.
Right.
They have spent decades studying targeted violence across various domains, workplaces, schools, public spaces, houses of worship.
And regardless of the venue, their findings reveal a remarkably consistent, almost haunting pattern.
I was actually reading through those NTD summaries in our sources, and the data is staggering.
It really is.
It shows that before these severe, catastrophic crises occur, the warning signs were almost always observed by someone.
Yes. The failure wasn't that nobody saw anything.
Exactly.
It wasn't a total absence of information. The failure was that nobody connected the information that was already there.
It is the crucial difference between the collection of data and the connection of data.
Collection versus connection. I love that.
Organizations absolutely love to collect data. They build elaborate reporting systems. They set up anonymous tip portals. They track login times. They monitor email sentiment.
They have terabytes of data.
They do. But early signals of risk, those things happening in the quiet space, are inherently informal and highly contextual.
So what happens is the information just gets completely siloed.
Yes. Human resources might have one piece of the puzzle. David's manager noted a sudden drop in his performance reviews.
Okay, that's piece one.
Physical security might have another piece. David has been swiping his badge to access the building at 2 a.m. on weekends for absolutely no apparent reason.
Me too.
And a frontline worker, a peer in the cubicle right next to him, might have a third piece. David has been making disturbing comments about feeling betrayed by the company.
So it's literally like an organization has 1,000 jigsaw puzzle pieces scattered across 50 different desks on 5 different floors.
That's exactly what it is.
And what is the standard corporate solution? They go out and hire one highly paid puzzle expert, like a risk manager or a threat assessment professional.
Yes, the lone expert.
They lock that expert in a basement office, and they expect them to magically see the whole picture.
All while the corporate culture upstairs is actively punishing employees if they leave their desks to go share their individual puzzle pieces with each other.
That is a perfect encapsulation of the structural failure right there. It is the myth of the lone expert.
We love hiring a single risk expert because it provides a psychological safety net for the leadership team.
It neatly delegates the liability.
Precisely. A CEO can point to that specific office and say, that person is in charge of prevention. If something goes wrong, it's on them.
But as Schneider argues so effectively, early risk simply does not present itself neatly to one person.
It never does. It presents as highly distributed, fragmented observations. No single person, no matter how credentialed, can observe all of it.
Because the expert is completely isolated from the day-to-day rhythm of the workforce.
Exactly.
If everyone in the company is culturally trained to wait for the expert to notice the problem, collective awareness just dies.
The frontline workers just assume, oh, we have a threat assessment guy now. He monitors the network. He must know David is acting weird. It's not my job to say anything.
And that assumption is fatal.
It is. But we have to dig deeper into the mechanics here. What is the actual physical barrier preventing the connection of this information?
Right. Why aren't they talking?
It isn't a lack of software. You mentioned anonymous portals earlier. The reality is an employee like Sarah, who sits right next to David, does not want to log into an intimidating formal HR portal to submit an ambiguous bad vibe.
She doesn't. She hesitates to formalize something she can't clearly name or prove.
Right. She doesn't want David to get fired. She just wants someone to check on him.
But if the organization is heavily siloed, where HR never talks to operations, and operations view security as just the people who issue parking passes, the information remains hopelessly fragmented.
The organization is literally holding all the necessary pieces to prevent a crisis, but no one is assembling the picture.
Because assembling the picture isn't a technology problem that you can solve with better software.
No, it's not.
It is a fundamental governance problem.
Precisely. The expert should be a partner in interpretation, not a gatekeeper of action.
That makes total sense.
Effective prevention requires distributed noticing, meaning every single employee is empowered to pay attention paired with expert synthesis.
But in most corporate structures, information has to travel strictly vertically.
Yes. A frontline worker tells a supervisor who sanitizes it and tells a director who filters it and tells a VP who finally emails the risk expert.
And by the time it reaches the expert, all the rich, nuanced, early context has been entirely stripped away.
It's no longer a story about a human being in distress. It's just a sterile, compressed bullet point in a weekly report.
So if the puzzle pieces are scattered, and we know absolutely that we need people to talk to each other to connect them, what stops them?
That's the million-dollar question.
Why doesn't Sarah just walk across the hall to her manager and say, "Hey, are you noticing this weird behavior with David too?"
The answer lies in something so subtle, so mundane, and so everyday that most leaders probably don't even realize they are doing it.
We are talking about the daily language used by the leadership team.
Language is the invisible architecture of an organization's entire culture.
I really want to spend a lot of time on this because this is where the rubber meets the road for anyone managing humans.
It really is.
We are talking about specific phrases that managers use every single day. Phrases that are intentionally meant to project calm, meant to show steady, rational leadership.
But actually serve to completely kill early engagement and enforce the quiet space.
Yes. Let's role play this for a second.
Okay, I'll be the manager.
Perfect. Sarah, the frontline employee, finally works up the courage to go to her manager. She says, "I'm really worried about David. He's been staring blankly at his screen. He snapped at me yesterday, and he just seems completely disconnected."
And as the manager, I respond with, "Do we have proof that his performance is dropping?" Or, "Let's not jump to conclusions," or, "Let's just wait and see if we get more information before we escalate anything."
Okay, now let's stop and analyze that manager's response. Because on the surface, in a vacuum, that sounds like exemplary, disciplined, rational leadership.
It really does. It sounds totally reasonable.
If I'm that manager, I think I'm doing a great job. I'm being objective. I'm protecting David from office gossip. I'm stopping a rumor mill.
But look at what those phrases actually do mechanically to the flow of information.
Right.
This is what Schneider categorizes as efficiency language.
Efficiency language.
When a leader responds to a concern by asking, "Do we have proof?" they are instantly shifting the entire burden of proof onto the employee who is least structurally equipped to provide it.
Because Sarah doesn't have access to David's emails. She doesn't have his performance metrics.
Exactly. She just has an observation. So what does she learn in that exact interaction?
She learns that her concern must be legally or quantitatively defensible before it is welcome in her manager's office.
She is taught in real time to wait for absolute certainty.
And as we established with the check engine light, by the time you have undeniable quantitative proof of a crisis, the opportunity for upstream prevention is already dead and gone.
You are now firmly in the reactive response phase.
But do we have proof? Isn't the only trap, is it?
No, not at all. There is also the profound danger of minimization.
Oh, minimization. Using words like minor isolated incident or it's probably nothing?
Yes. The manager tells Sarah, "Oh, David's just having a bad week. It's probably nothing."
And the manager's intent is just to prevent Sarah from overreacting.
But the actual outcome is that the manager actively shrinks the concern before it has even been explored or understood.
And the next time Sarah sees something weird,
she self-filters. She thinks, "Well, my boss thought I was crazy last time and said it was nothing, so I guess I'm just overreacting again."
Minimization immediately shuts down the conversational pathway.
It completely signals to the employee that the case is closed, when in reality, exploration is what is desperately needed.
And this dynamic ties directly into a very nuanced distinction Schneider makes regarding how we communicate observations, right? Naming versus labeling.
This is a huge concept.
Break down the mechanics of naming versus labeling for us.
So naming is the act of objectively describing what is being observed in reality.
Okay, give me an example.
For example, David has been showing up 30 minutes late for the past week. He is sitting silently in our brainstorming meetings, and his tone in emails has become noticeably terse.
Right. That is naming the behavior. It is purely factual.
Exactly. Labeling, however, jumps straight to assigning intent, diagnosis, or blame.
Okay.
Labeling is saying David is a toxic employee, or David is a threat to the workplace, or David is depressed.
So labeling is basically playing amateur psychologist or judge.
Precisely. And people naturally hesitate to speak up because they are terrified of labeling.
Right, because Sarah doesn't want to accuse David of being a threat. She feels completely unqualified to make that judgment.
And she knows the consequences of that label are severe.
If the organization does not actively cultivate a vocabulary that separates objective observation naming from conclusive judgment labeling, then silence becomes the only safe option for the employee.
They will just wait until the label is obvious to absolutely everyone.
Okay, but I have a larger question here.
Lay it on me.
I'm putting myself in the shoes of a mid-level manager right now, and I'm feeling a lot of friction about this.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Aren't leaders supposed to prevent panic? Aren't they supposed to stop witch hunts and office paranoia?
That's the standard thinking, yes.
So if Sarah comes to me with a vague, unsubstantiated feeling about David, and I don't ask her for proof, aren't I just inviting a toxic, paranoid culture? Like a culture where everyone is just constantly reporting on each other's bad vibes.
This raises an important question, and it's probably the most valid pushback you will hear from management.
Right.
It's exactly why leaders default to efficiency language in the first place. They are desperately trying to protect the system from being overwhelmed by noise and paranoia.
Exactly.
But this raises a fundamental question about leadership capability. Is there a middle ground? Do we only have two options, demanding absolute, undeniable proof, or blindly validating every single paranoid rumor that crosses our desk?
Right. It feels like a false dichotomy.
It is. Schneider argues that a third option exists, and it is built through what he calls enabling language.
Enabling language. Mechanically, how does that actually sound in a conversation? Like, how do I respond to Sarah?
It requires a pivot from demanding closure to inviting context.
Inviting context.
Instead of shutting the door by asking, "Do you have proof?" you open the door wider by simply saying, "Tell me more about what you're noticing." Instead of commanding, "Let's not jump to conclusions," you ask an exploratory question. What feels different about David's behavior this week compared to last month?
Or like, has anyone else on the team mentioned observing this?
Exactly. You are distinguishing between amplifying fear and engaging with curiosity.
It's leading with curiosity instead of demanding a verdict.
Enabling language keeps the conversation open specifically to build context. By saying, "Tell me more," you aren't committing the company to a disciplinary escalation.
Right. You aren't opening a formal legal HR investigation.
No, you are merely holding space for uncertainty. You are broadcasting a cultural signal that says it is safe to share incomplete information in this office.
It completely takes the pressure off the employee. You aren't asking Sarah to deliver a guilty verdict on David. You're just asking her to share a data point.
Tell me what you're seeing. That is incredibly powerful.
But let's look at the macro level for a second. When informal language and middle management conversations fail to capture these issues, which, let's be honest, they often do,
Very often.
organizations usually panic. They realize they have a blind spot, and they immediately turn to formal, heavy structures.
They ramp up rigid compliance rules.
And they institute formal threat assessment teams. But as we see in the sources, these formal structures are inherently limited by their own design.
Let's talk about compliance first, because compliance is fascinating.
It really is.
It provides executive boards with such a profound, almost intoxicating sense of comfort.
Oh, they love it. You survive your annual audits, all your documentation is perfectly up to date in the system.
Every single employee clicked through the mandatory 45-minute online training video and took the quiz.
It creates a psychological illusion that you are perfectly insulated from risk.
The false confidence of compliance.
Because if we really think about the mechanics of it, what does compliance actually measure?
It measures what is legally or procedurally required.
It measures the past. It measures whether you checked a box. It absolutely does not measure what is emerging in the present moment.
Exactly. The early signals of risk, that subtle, murky, quiet space we've been exploring with David and Sarah, exist entirely before formal policies apply.
In the quiet space, no rule has actually been broken yet.
Right. So if an organization relies entirely on its compliance dashboard to gauge its health, it has engineered a massive structural blind spot.
Everything looks perfectly correct, green, and healthy on paper, while a catastrophic risk is developing completely unnoticed right beneath the surface.
A compliance-heavy culture literally waits for a violation to occur instead of engaging with early behavioral signals.
And this structural delay ties right into the function of threat assessment teams.
It does. Now, we need to be very clear here. Structured professional threat assessment is absolutely essential.
Totally. We need these teams.
But Schneider points out a critical systemic flaw when organizations lean on threat assessment as their only tool for prevention.
The flaw is chronological, right?
Yes. Threat assessment, by its very nature, requires a formal referral. Someone has to submit a case.
Therefore, it is entirely downstream from the initial observation.
This is where the ER doctor analogy comes in.
I love this analogy. I think about it like a hospital. Threat assessment is the emergency room doctor.
Yes.
ER doctors do incredible, high-stakes, life-saving work. But imagine a scenario where you, as a patient, feel a strange, painless lump on your arm.
You know it's there.
You know it's there, but you refuse to go to your primary care doctor. You just wait. You wait for months watching it grow because you have convinced yourself you are waiting until it's bad enough to require emergency surgery.
And if you eventually collapse, get rushed to the hospital and die on the operating table.
That is not a failure of the ER doctor. The ER doctor did everything right based on when you arrived.
Exactly.
That is a failure of the patient for waiting so long to seek intervention. Organizations are treating their threat assessment teams like the corporate ER. They are waiting for the tumor to be massive.
That analogy perfectly conceptualizes the structural gap in modern risk management.
There is a massive, incredibly dangerous gap in time and severity between a frontline worker like Sarah noticing a subtle behavioral drift, the proverbial strange lump.
And David's behavior degrading to the point where it becomes severe enough to meet the formal, documented threshold for a threat assessment team to legally intervene.
Wow.
If threat assessment is your only lever to pull, you are compressing the entire concept of prevention into a brief, episodic, high-stakes review.
Rather than treating it as a sustained, daily practice of awareness.
You are literally waiting for the crisis to mature enough to become legally actionable.
You are waiting for David to make an explicit threat before you try to help him.
Precisely. And in doing so, you place a completely unfair and impossible burden on your threat assessment professionals.
Because by design, they're always arriving late to the trajectory of the risk.
Think about the options you had early on. The options for quiet, relational correction.
Like a manager just sitting down with David over coffee, asking how he's doing, offering EAP resources.
Adjusting his workload. Those low-cost options have completely evaporated by the time the formal assessment is triggered.
Now it's adversarial. Now it's about containment.
So to bridge this massive gap, the gap between Sarah noticing the weird vibe on Tuesday and the ER threat assessment team getting called in 6 months later, an organization has to do something much harder than buying software.
It has to fundamentally change its culture.
It has to shift from relying solely on rigid, heavily documented systems to functioning more like a human community.
And that brings us to the concept of the prevention-minded organization, and specifically the tension between care and control.
This is where Schneider really asks leaders to shift their entire paradigm.
Because historically, we have always framed risk management and security around the concept of control.
Control looks like surveillance cameras, strict compliance audits, access badges, zero tolerance policies.
And executive authority. But Schneider argues that true early prevention must be reframed as an act of care.
Now I know what you're thinking.
Yeah, I have to admit, it sounds a little touchy-feely at first. If I'm a hardened corporate executive, care sounds like an HR buzzword that doesn't actually stop a data breach.
But he defines care not as a warm, fuzzy sentiment, but as a disciplined, sustained attention to people.
It's not about being soft. It's about being observant.
Exactly. It is a highly strategic posture. It's about recognizing the psychological reality of your workforce.
Which is what?
When employees believe the organization genuinely cares about their well-being and the well-being of their colleagues, speaking up feels like a shared communal value.
It feels like you are taking care of your community.
Conversely, when prevention is framed entirely as surveillance and control, speaking up feels like participating in a snitch culture.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
People will instinctively protect their peers from a system they view as punitive and adversarial.
They will not protect their peers from a system they view as genuinely supportive and restorative.
If Sarah thinks reporting David will get him fired, she stays quiet. If she thinks reporting him will get him help, she speaks up.
There is a line from the sources that perfectly captures this. Control seeks compliance. Care seeks understanding.
That explains exactly why communities are inherently better at prevention than rigid systems.
Let's explicitly contrast the two models. Formal systems require documentation, defined thresholds, drop-down menus, and clear categories of violation.
Right. And if Sarah's nuanced concern about David doesn't neatly fit the predefined drop-down menu on the HR portal,
the system literally rejects the data.
But communities, however, operate through relationships, informality, and early, low-stakes intervention.
Think about a literal neighborhood community.
Right. If you notice something slightly off about your next-door neighbor, maybe their mail is piling up or they look disheveled, you don't go back into your house, log onto a portal, and fill out a grievance form in triplicate for the HOA.
No, you just walk across the fence line and say, "Hey, man, is everything okay?"
You share context. You might casually compare notes with the neighbor across the street. "Hey, have you seen John lately? He seems down."
It's entirely organic, because informality drastically lowers the personal and social cost of paying attention.
In a rigid corporate system, escalating an issue has a massive social and professional cost. You might be wrong. You might ruin someone's career.
In a community, having a brief, empathetic conversation has almost zero cost.
But, I mean, let's get ruthlessly practical for a second. What does this all mean for a modern, complex workplace?
We can't just scrap the formal HR reporting portals, fire all the compliance officers, and sit around in drum circles sharing our feelings.
Exactly. How do you actually scale the concept of a community in a massive multinational corporation with 10,000 employees spread across four continents?
Well, you don't scrap the systems. The systems are legally and operationally necessary. You contextualize them.
You design your organizational architecture for both.
You have to intentionally preserve and protect spaces for informal, low-stakes dialogue to exist alongside the formal compliance structures.
So what does a truly prevention-minded organization look like in practice?
It has a few key hallmarks. First, attention is distributed, meaning every employee is trained to be a sensor, not just the security guards.
Okay, second.
Second, uncertainty is engaged, not avoided. When someone brings up a vague concern, leaders lean in with enabling language rather than shutting it down.
Tell me more.
Exactly. Third, information moves laterally across departments, meaning HR, security, and operations regularly talk to each other about trends, not just specific violations.
And finally, responses are proportional.
Proportionality is absolutely key.
It means creating low-cost pathways for early concerns to be heard.
Right. So a manager can walk down the hall to HR and say, "Look, I don't have a formal write-up. David hasn't broken any rules, but I just want to talk through this weird dynamic I'm seeing on my team."
And crucially, HR doesn't immediately panic and launch a full-scale legal investigation.
Instead, they act as a consultant. They coach the manager on how to have a supportive, de-escalating conversation with David.
You are keeping the dialogue open and gathering context without triggering the nuclear option.
But to address your point about scaling this across a massive enterprise, it requires a monumental investment of leadership time.
It requires managers to have the emotional bandwidth to sit with ambiguity and not rush to a solution.
Leaders have to be willing to engage with the messy reality of human behavior when there is no immediate crisis explicitly forcing them to do so.
Which brings up the most inevitable common objection you will hear from literally any C-suite executive.
We don't have time for this.
We are running a global business. We have quarterly earnings to hit. We are too busy executing our strategy to sit around discussing the vague, unsubstantiated bad vibes of every employee.
And to those leaders, Schneider delivers a devastating counterargument.
You need to deeply examine the invisible, crushing financial and cultural costs of doing nothing.
Let's dive into the final major concept of our deep dive, the invisible invoice.
Or the true cost of ignoring prevention.
Leaders defer action in the quiet space because uncertainty is deeply uncomfortable, and engaging with it takes valuable time away from their primary objectives.
But this avoidance creates what Schneider so accurately calls the false economy of delay.
Because waiting feels cheaper today, doing nothing costs $0 right now.
It does. It preserves the illusion of stability in the short term. The budget looks great this quarter.
But waiting does not preserve your neutrality. It simply hands all of your leverage over to circumstance.
You are allowing the underlying risk to mature and gather momentum.
What could have been completely resolved with a 15-minute, informal, empathetic conversation with David today will absolutely require a 3-month, multi-million-dollar legal investigation complete with outside counsel and PR firms next year.
It's the minimum balance on a credit card analogy.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
Ignoring prevention is exactly like deciding to only pay the minimum balance on a high-interest credit card. It feels incredibly cheap today.
You look at your bank account and think, great, I saved cash this month. I'm a financial genius.
But beneath the surface, you are quietly accumulating massive compounding interest.
And when the bill finally comes due, when David's behavior escalates into a scandal, a violent incident, or a massive lawsuit, it completely bankrupts you.
Companies enthusiastically budget for the crisis response. They have retainers for crisis PR, insurance policies, but they absolutely refuse to budget time and energy for the daily practice of prevention.
And that invisible invoice is staggering when you break down the line items.
These are catastrophic costs that do not appear neatly on a quarterly balance sheet until it's way too late.
You have executive leadership time completely derailed and diverted to crisis management for months.
You have the massive hard costs of legal defense and internal investigations.
You suffer the devastating loss of institutional trust. Your employees no longer feel safe. Your customers don't trust your brand. Your board loses faith in the CEO.
And you experience massive employee attrition. Highly competent people will simply leave organizations that they perceive to be unsafe, reactive, or mismanaged.
But the most haunting cost of all, the one that really sticks with me long after reading the material, is a concept Schneider calls moral residue.
Moral residue.
This is perhaps the most profound psychological concept in the entire book. We have to look at the deep, lingering psychological toll on the workforce after an incident actually occurs.
I want to go back to Sarah to explain this. Imagine being Sarah.
Okay.
The incident happened. David finally snapped. It's on the news. The alarms are blaring.
And Sarah is sitting at her desk, realizing that she noticed the warning signs 6 months ago.
She heard the weird comments. She saw the behavioral drift.
But she also remembers that the organization had culturally conditioned her to stay quiet.
She knew that if she spoke up without hard proof, her manager would dismiss her or label her a troublemaker.
So prioritizing her own job security, she stayed silent.
And then the absolute worst-case scenario becomes a reality. The silent, agonizing burden that Sarah carries for the rest of her life, the guilt, the endless loop of, what if I had just said something? That is moral residue.
It is a devastating weight to carry, and it extends upward to leadership as well.
When you look at post-incident after-action reviews, whether it's a corporate collapse or a violent tragedy, they almost always reveal that the harm was not entirely unforeseeable.
The puzzle pieces were sitting right there on the desks.
The tragedy is that, in the aftermath, organizations almost never learn the right lesson.
They become infinitely more brittle after a crisis.
Driven by liability and fear, they add more rules, they buy more compliant software, they build more rigid systems.
Rather than doing the hard work of learning how to pay attention to each other earlier,
they rapidly expand their policies while their actual human awareness contracts.
They try to purchase more safety instead of building a culture of care.
They buy a bigger check engine light instead of teaching their managers how to listen to the engine.
Precisely. The ultimate cost of ignoring prevention is not just the financial damage of the incident itself. It is the permanent loss of the organization's humanity, its cohesion, and its adaptability.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and summarize this incredible journey we've been on.
It's been a lot.
We started by entirely reframing how we look at risk. We look at that quiet space before a crisis, a murky space filled with ambiguity, where the standard deeply ingrained organizational reflex is to sit back and wait for undeniable proof.
We learned that true prevention is not a 4K camera system in the lobby.
It's not an anonymous HR hotline.
And it's certainly not an isolated risk expert locked in a basement office trying to solve a puzzle blindfolded.
We examined the mechanical power of language. We saw how efficiency language managers asking for hard proof or minimizing subtle concerns can unintentionally silence an entire workforce.
And how a simple pivot to enabling language saying, tell me more, can invite the crucial early context needed to stop a trajectory of harm.
We recognize the absolute necessity of compliance systems and formal threat assessment teams while openly admitting their fatal flaw. They arrive far too late to the party.
They require a culture of care and informal community to feed them early signals. Otherwise, they are just conducting corporate autopsies.
Ultimately, prevention is not a product. It is a leadership posture.
It lives entirely in the quiet space where ambiguity is explored with curiosity, not shut down by a demand for certainty.
It requires the discipline of attention before the necessity of action.
So well said.
So here's the call to action for you. Because even if you aren't a Fortune 500 CEO or a corporate executive with a massive budget, You manage environments.
You manage a team of graphic designers, or a third-grade classroom, or a neighborhood volunteer group, or a family.
You have direct influence over a culture. How do you handle the quiet space in your world?
Do you demand absolute certainty before you are willing to listen?
Do you reward the people around you for bringing you half-formed, messy concerns? Or do you make them feel like they are a burden for lacking proof?
Because if you are waiting for the alarm to blare before you finally decide to engage, you are already entirely out of options.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for this deep dive. I want you to think back to a specific conversation you shut down recently.
Maybe it was an employee at work. Maybe it was your partner at home.
You shut it down because the person didn't have all the facts yet, or they were just bringing you a vague feeling that annoyed you.
Think about that exact moment.
What would happen tomorrow if you went back to them, sat down, looked them in the eye, and simply said, "Hey, I've been thinking. Tell me more about what you were noticing."
How might that one tiny, almost imperceptible shift in your language completely alter the entire trajectory of an unseen crisis?
You know, at the very beginning of this conversation, we talked about medical diagnoses, how we desperately want the problems in our organizations to be like a cleanly broken bone on an X-ray, stark, bright white, undeniably clear.
We want the alarms to blare so we know exactly what to do.
But the profound truth of human behavior and the complex reality of risk is that the X-ray is always blurry at first.
It always is.
The question isn't whether you can see the prod perfectly on day one. The question is whether you care enough about the person in front of you to keep looking while it's still murky.